Cambridge Breakfast.
Cambridge 105 Radio.
Now, it's an historic day as in Westminster as MPs will finally vote on Theresa May's Brexit deal this evening. The agreement is widely expected to be defeated in the Commons. Many think that Brexit of any sort could have a serious impact on our city. Caoimhe O'Kane has written about this with his colleague Ben Steventon at the paper No Brexit Opportunities on the Horizon for Cambridgeshire. And it's not looking good for our flourishing research sector. Caoimhe is here with us this morning. Good morning. Thank you for coming in.
Pleasure.
Mm-hmm.
The size, I don't know how one quantifies these things, but the size of the research market in Cambridge, how would you define it?
Well, there's a lot of centres. I mean, most people think of the university to begin with, where there's a lot of research activity. But in addition to that, there are research institutes like the MRC, Laboratory of Molecular Biology, on the Edinburgh site, other institutes there, Babraham Institute near Babraham, and also newer operations like AstraZeneca building up as well.
So we think, I guess, in the first thing, people, oh, the researchers, you know, people in white coats hanging around the university. But actually, it's much, much more than that, because there are the companies you mention, and I guess also companies which are maybe spun off from the university or simply on drawing on the expertise of people who either once have and maybe will be again be studying there.
Yeah, of course, that's the basis of a lot of the enterprises on the science parks around Cambridge, which the Trinity one's the best known one, but there are others as well scattered around the edge of the city.
So what could happen here? And in terms of funding, first of all, specifically on that, how much of the money you get to do your job, to do your research, comes at this time from the European Union in some shape or form?
So the university as a whole, 2015, when I looked up the figures a couple of years ago, it was as much as the two biomedical research councils put together, the Medical Research Council and the Biotechnology and Biological Sciences Research Council. So I think that are up to about £60 million. Mm. And that's just the university. So the other institutes will have their funding as well. I don't have the numbers to hand for that. But a lot of it, it's not just the amount of funding, it's the nature of funding as well. So my own research group last year, I had six people in it, and the two most senior people were funded by EU fellowships. So that was to encourage mobility. That's fellowships where you have to change country, and those are open to anyone in the world, not just anyone in the EU, but anyone in the world to come to any EU country, including up to now the UK.
If I was a Brexiteer, I might be, I'm not allowed to say, I would be saying, oh, well, but we'll be saving, because we'll not be paying in all this money into Europe, we'll have all this spare money, which we'll be able to put into research instead. Would that help?
Well, it would compensate to some extent. It might compensate for some of the financial loss, although, to be honest, given government track record, I can't see them compensating for all of it. And it's also the nature. So there's the funding of mobility, and the UK does have some schemes for funding mobility as well, people to come to the UK. But I think one of the big two of the big losses would be, firstly, the collaborative nature. Like one example recently was a large study of new breast cancer mutations involving the Sanger Centre outside of Cambridge, which is a multi-centre collaboration across Europe. And for those multi-centre collaborations, it's really quite difficult to set up large numbers of participants without that overarching funding source. Mm. And the freedom of movement as well is something that's also vital. People can just come and go depending on need, rather than having to go through complex visa application and expensive visa applications.
It's really strange, actually, because, you know, the European Union often gets accused of, you know, causing a whole load of paperwork and bureaucracy as if it didn't exist before 1973 in any form. And now, from what you're saying, even though people are standing and saying, oh, yes, but, you know, we'll be able to draw on people not just from Europe, but from across the world. You're saying that, yeah, that might happen, but they'll have to fill in a whole load of forms in order to do so. And I'm assuming it's not just a matter of spending an hour with a ballpoint pen to do that.
No, the forms are quite. I have gone through them with people in my lab before, and I'm very glad to have people from anywhere in the world coming. But it's not the EU that's stopping us from doing that. It's the UK's own immigration procedures.
Oh, really?
Yes.
So
yeah.
You would say that there should be some, I don't know, lightening up. But, of course, at the same time, one of the things which got us to where we are is a fear, a concern amongst some people that far too many people are coming in.
Well, I remember at the time of the referendum going round our department and just asking people in the corridor and labs, offices, everywhere I met, what percentage of the UK population did they think was made up of people from other EU countries? And from about 20 or 30 people, I got answers ranging from 5% to 40%, with an average around 15 to 20%. And even the people who said 40% didn't have a problem with that.
Yeah.
But the average was about 15 to 20% that people said. But actually, it was 5%.
Wow.
And Ireland, it's 8%, but it's not an issue.
Yeah.
Obviously, there are issues with potential issues with infrastructure if you've a lot of new people coming into an area. But those are problems you deal with them, and there should be ways to deal with them. Not because of the benefits that they bring to a community, and should try to make those benefits flow back to everyone in the community rather than just being afraid of new people coming in.
I wonder. We don't know, obviously tonight. We don't know what's going to happen. It could, well, we know that Theresa is probably going to lose, but it's how much she loses by and then what happens after that. But I figure that even if things do have a turnaround and say we do end up staying in, has damage already been done?
I think so. So obviously I think it could be repaired if we do remain. But the biggest thing I've noticed is that before the referendum, I would typically get five or six people a year from continental Europe asking if they could come and spend a few months in my lab just to learn experience. And that has all dried up. I've only had one serious applicant since the referendum.
But that could swing back again, surely.
I think that could swing back quite quickly if it did go to remain.
Yeah. And I have to ask, it'd be blindingly obvious to most people that you come from Ireland. Whereabouts?
County Derry in Northern Ireland.
Okay. How do you feel about the backstop?
Well, I am very relieved about that. Well, firstly, I wish we weren't here where we are, but we are where we are. And if we are where we are, I think the people I talk to are very relieved to have the backstop because the peace settlement had got as far as the border was no longer the first thing you thought of when you got up in the morning.
Mm.
But it has become that again. And I think keeping an open border is so important just for the way people think about where they live and the way that they feel accepted. Where they live.
I remember in the 1980s, I did a radio tour with some friends of mine. There were a lot of pirate radio stations broadcasting in Ireland, in the south. And in particular, there were a few what they called border blasters, who were basically set up in the on the Irish side of the border, if we can describe it as such, and basically beaming their shows. In fact, our very own Steffi Callister worked on one of them. But the point is that we were travelling around and we'd inadvertently straddled from one side of the border to the other, and we'd be met. We'd be met by British troops, and we were having a most ordinary conversation about what radio we did with somebody carrying a machine gun
on
British soil. And that's just as a visitor. If you're with that every day.
I know. You would hate to go back to that again.
Yeah.
It's very upsetting to think that it could go back, because I think if there is a no deal Brexit, I can't see how you can then avoid a hard border with customs posts. And I think for customs posts to survive any length of time, I think they will have to be fortified and militarised. And I don't think we'll go back to that situation immediately, but it will increase the tension and it will provide targets that don't need to be there in the first place, and that I think will inevitably increase tension.
Yeah. How long have you been in Cambridge now?
Been in Cambridge 25 years. Yeah.
And you kept the accent, or you top it up when you go back?
No, I top it up when I go back. I've lost some of the rough edges of it, but I can't manage to speak with an English accent. If I try to put on an English accent, it hurts my face muscles.
Well, I think we might have to get you in to do that another time, actually. Thank you very much for coming in this morning. Now, your paper, we mentioned, no Brexit opportunities on the horizon for Cambridgeshire. Can anybody get a copy of that if they want to have a read?
Yes, of course. I'm on Twitter, OK and Cahir, and there's also Cambridge Stays Facebook page that people can follow, and I'm sure they can make a copy of it available there. So
okay, that's cool. Well, look, thank you very much for coming in and chatting us this morning. That's Cahir O'Kane, Dr. Cahir O'Kane, and that takes the time to 8:21. Cambridge 105.